Now that you're sitting, let's stand. O Heavenly King, the Comforter and Spirit of Truth, Lord, who are present and fillest all things, treasure of blessings, giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us of all impurity, save our souls, O good one. Amen. All right, I missed you last week, but my better was here, and I think you talked about probably prayer, the hours of prayer, and you know the cycle of prayer. Is that correct? No. What did he talk about?
But not the cycles, or the hours.
Did he talk about the like vespers, matins, things like that?
Yeah, he gave us.
What did he do? Yeah. Talk about the creed?
No, he talked about prayer. And
okay. Oh my. Looks like a college professor, doesn't it? Either or, coffee shop in Southeast PDX. What did he say about that?
Either or, as it relates to both and. There's a lot of both ands.
Duality, remembrance. Well, I should have been here. It looks fascinating.
He did talk about the creeds.
Okay. All right, well, that wasn't what I thought he was talking about, but since it's his class, he gets to do it. All right. So last time I was here, we took a major sidebar into Gehenna and all that sort of thing. And any residual questions from any of that? It's been 2 weeks. You've probably forgotten it all now, right? You do know the difference between Hades and hell now, don't you? Right. And I forgot the Latin word. For hell, it's infernus, like infernal, right? And the word that was used in Latin for Hades, as opposed to hell, is infernus. Let me think for just a minute. It's an additional word that goes with it that clarifies it. Demiurge. Infernus demiurge. Yeah. So that would be their language. And then that second word was dropped over time, and infernus was used all the time for both parts. Okay, so, yes?
The other thing you talked about was remembrance last week, by the way.
Remembrance, like dead people and things like that?
The remembrance as it relates to the Eucharist, and do this in remembrance.
Oh, so he talked about anamnesis.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
But there was another word you said that...
Anamnesis is the opposite of forgetting. Anamnesis is to bring to remembrance. But as I'm sure he talked about, there's a difference between bringing to remembrance. In other words, I think about something that happened when I was 5 years old and think about it and sort of remember it. What it means is bringing it into the present moment. So when he said, do this in remembrance of me, what he's saying is, I'll be there with you. Someone doesn't like their parking spot, I guess. I'll come into the present moment. So that's a crucial thing. And we use that word a lot during the Great Entrance. So we'll talk about it then. What's that?
I don't know.
Maybe somebody's in distress. Well, yeah, check. Yeah, I have no idea. Maybe it is. Yeah, all right. All right, so any questions about this week or things I can't answer from last week?
The two words, again, anamnesis and the other word.
Well, you know amnesia, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so anamnesis is the opposite.
Right, so those are the
to forget, to remember. You're wondering about the word Eucharistic?
It is.
What's that, Jack?
The other word you can talk
about
is Eucharistia.
Eucharistia.
Eucharistia, Thanksgiving, right? Yeah.
Is there a distinction, and this is what I tried to remember from the class I took before, is there a distinction between remembering your birthday 20 years ago and doing this in remembrance? Are there two separate words? Or is it anamnesis? Is the only word that describes that, or was
No, there are several words in Greek. I'm not sure what they all are, but anamnesis is a very specific word.
Okay.
You know, it's like the word, a word that we will use a lot in class. John, was that you doing all that honking out there?
It wasn't my idea, I swear.
That was the signal to come get the blind guy, right? Okay. All right, we got it. Now we know. Okay. So there are a lot of words that we use today that don't convey biblical truths effectively, you know, English translations of words. And one of those would be the word, for instance, symbol. Okay, so a symbol to us would be like if you're driving down the road and you see an octagonal sign, what kind of sign is it? Don't you do crossword puzzles? Stop! Right, and it's bright red. Okay, so that's our symbol, you know, to stop. Okay, but in the Greek, the word symbolos is, I don't think the heat is on. It's not quite warm enough in here, and I probably won't be able to see this thing. But I'll give it a shot. Whole temp. Yeah, it's at 53. That's good. So this should warm things up right about the time we leave. Okay. All right. So the word that in Greek, symbolos, that we get our word symbol from is very different than that, at least in its original meaning. So, for instance, the Nicene Creed is described as, if you've ever seen this in a book or something, it will say the symbol of our faith. So when I was a young Orthodox Christian and I saw that, I thought, well, what does that mean exactly? Does it represent our faith? Like a stop sign means to stop? Because I thought that the Nicene Creed was kind of the essence of the faith, not something symbolic about it, but the thing itself. Well, what the word actually means, symbolos, and we use it very often in liturgy and things like that, symbolos means in Greek to make clear, whole, and complete. You know, to make something clear, okay, to give the meaning of it. So when we call the creed the symbol of our faith, it isn't symbolic of something, but rather it's saying this is making it clear. Okay, so this makes it clear. This is what our faith is. And the opposite of that word, can you guess what it is? To make things unclear, to divide, to separate. What word would that be? Diabolos. Yeah, and you know how we use that word, right? Okay, so the devil is the divider, the one who takes away clarity, who brings clouds and shadiness onto things. So those are two opposite words, symbolos, to make clear, diabolos, to make unclear and to divide. Okay, so there are words that we're constantly, through the course of catechism, constantly reclaiming and changing the meaning of so that we understand them, not just the way we use them in English now, but the way that they were understood and used back then. Okay? And anamnesis, or to bring to remembrance, is one of those words. Because to us, it's think back to when you were five. But in the Greek meaning of the word anamnesis, what it means is you could almost say, bring me into the present when the Lord says it, when the Lord uses it. Bring me into that present moment. You know, do this in remembrance of me, I'll be there. Okay. Not thinking back to the Last Supper 2,000 years ago.
So it's almost as if it is the same Last Supper that was being experienced back then. It's a continuation of, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that would be how we understand it. An endless continuation, celebrated often.
And is the crucifixion the same way when you think on the Friday?
Well,
it's perpetually happening.
Yeah, all of those things have a perpetual quality to them. Okay, in the timelessness of heaven. Okay, not in the.
But you're not re-crucifying.
That would be the great fear, right? Putting Jesus back on the cross.
Well, I don't know. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around.
Well, I just went into my Protestant mentality for a minute when you said that, remembering what I was taught as a kid.
Right, so how do I put that together? How do I
Okay. Well, in that case, we have to use two words. One is chronos, and the other is kairos. Okay? Now, chronos is what we live in here, like this extension of time that makes Ken a 4-year-old and then a 20-year-old and so on. Yeah, and kairos, you could say. Kairos is timelessness. So this, you know, we know that in God's time there is no time. A day is as 1,000 years and so on, right? And so when we have the divine liturgy, for instance, the beginning of the it opens with blessed is the kingdom, because it's a sacrament of the church, and therefore it's a part of the kingdom, not a part of chronos, but a part of kairos. So we in a sense we go through all the actions of what happened, the saving actions of Christ in the divine liturgy. And it isn't that we're re-crucifying him or that we're re-resurrecting him or something like that, but there's a timeless quality to all of it. There's even a statement in the Eucharistic service that I always get a kick out of, and it's right before the anaphora, or the offering, takes place, you know, the offering of the gifts. And I'm trying to remember it. I have it memorized in the service, but I can't always pull it out when I don't have it in context. And let's see, the cross, the tomb, the resurrection on the third day, the ascension into heaven, the sitting at the right hand, and thy second and glorious coming. Now, has that happened yet? Second and glorious coming? All those other things have, but that hasn't. And yet here we are celebrating it, right? And commemorating thy second and glorious coming. Well, you can do that in kairos because we know it's going to happen, right? Yeah, in that sense, we're outside of time. So it's more, to wrap our, you know, our little pea brains around stuff like that can be pretty hard.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of like, so we have the word kairos, and it means timelessness, and what the heck does that mean? Yeah, yeah. We put the best words we can on it, but it's really ultimately fairly inexplicable. It would be what Paul experienced when he went to the third heaven. Yeah, and what did he say? I don't know if I was in the body or out. Words can't describe it. I can't talk about it. Yeah. Right. That'd be the CIA. Yeah. What is the third heaven? We're getting nowhere tonight. Okay. The third heaven is a Jewish expression. Okay. So Paul was speaking from his Jewishness. And the third heaven was the highest heaven. Dale, am I right? You can tell me if I'm wrong. I have a Hebrew scholar here, so I always have to refer to him. Abraham's bosom. Yeah. All right. He's letting me off the hook. There may be a fourth or fifth, eh? but in my research, you know, in preparing sermons on that text, my understanding is that the third heaven is the highest heaven, you know, which would be where the throne of God is. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I knew about that.
Okay.
Over 2.5 years of it.
All right. Oh yeah, that area. All right. Yeah. All right. Anything else from any of that? All right. Then we'll go back to our tour, which we haven't been on in what?
3 weeks.
A month or something like that. All right. So if just to refresh you, We started our class with touring the church so that you could know what's where and why it's there and that sort of thing. And we basically did the things mostly down on this level. So I want to take you up to the altar area, the iconostasis and that sort of thing, and explain what's there, which requires you to get up and come with me. Okay, this wall across here is called the iconostas, which means icon stand. It's nothing fancy about it. You can see why it's called that, can't you? Okay, so things are placed here in a particular way. Now, certainly in the very early church, there wasn't something like this. Okay, it was mostly in people's homes. It was in the temple until they were kicked out of the temple, in people's homes. As they, you know, began to develop churches, they built a separation between the altar area and the nave of the church, okay, so that someone wouldn't be mistaken by that and just kind of walk in. Over time, this is what we have, and this is in the center is called the holy doors. These are opened only at certain times during the service. And what you see on the holy doors, it's a very symbolic, in the way we talked about earlier, it's a very symbolic thing in its meaning. In the center of it, normally, if things were done like large and proper, you would see a large of the Annunciation here. So the Archangel Gabriel announcing to the Theotokos that she would become the Mother of God, okay, that it would be a virgin birth, and so on. So that's right in the center. And then on the holy doors are the four apostles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the gospel writers. Okay, so that would be the case in pretty much every church you would go to. And then on this side and that side are the two comings of Christ. Now, some would say, well, this is an icon of the Mother of God, this is an icon of Jesus, but this is really an icon of Jesus, incarnation icon, okay? So if you're close enough to see it, I'll just show you a few things about it. I'm not going to go exhaustively into things because it would take too long. But
Can we come up? Yeah,
come right up. Yeah. And by the way, you can come up here, you know, during church or that sort of thing. It's not a taboo place. So this icon is called the Sweet Kissing. I can't remember in Russian what it is. These are all painted in the context of 17th century Russian iconography. Why? Because Father Matthew loves it. So I had that type painted. But I think they're beautiful. I think they kind of hit right in the balance, you know, between the Byzantine severity and what our sensibilities are. So just a few things to point out. In the image of Christ, he looks like a baby and an old man, right? Well, most little boys do look like babies and old men. A lot of them I've seen. But he's shown in this way like a baby because he's fully man, but like an old man because he's fully God. Fully God and fully man. So incarnate as both. All right? Now, you also see, this is kind of neat, his hand is around here. So as fully man, how does he feel about his mother?
Loves her.
Right, loves her. He's kissing her. He's close to her. He's taking comfort from her. And, you know, sometimes we go too far on the fully God or sometimes too far on the fully man. It's always a balance. You know, it's a perfect balance. And so sometimes we have a little bit of a hard time thinking that, say, for instance, God would actually love his mother because he's God. He's above all that, right? But he's fully man. So we have to fully enter into that as well. It's the only way that Christology makes sense, is when we balance the two. And then you see with her, she's holding him, but almost like not touching him, right? She's the embrace is one of awe, because she knows that, yes, this is her child, and he's going to be having dinner at her breast tonight, but at the same time, it's God incarnate. So how do you deal with that? It's reminiscent of the icon of St. Simeon, you know, when the Lord is taken into the temple. And St. Simeon, you know, the prophet who's in the temple at the meeting in the temple, he has his hands and he's saying, I'm holding fire. What will happen to me? You know? So, and you see a star here, and you would see another one behind him if he weren't blocking it. And the meaning of that is that she's fully virgin before, during, and after. Okay, so her entire life was that of being a virgin. Now, while we're at this icon, We talk a lot liturgically in prayers and services about the Theotokos. We've talked about that before. Theos, God. Tokos, bearer, the God bearer. Now, that's a name that she was given not so much because of her, but because of him. Because in the period of the First and Second Councils, particularly during the First Council, the heretic Arius, who believed that Christ was not fully God, was more like an angel of some sort and a very powerful man, wanted to call her the Christotokos, which is the bearer of Christ. Well, that is not a problem for us because when we hear the word Christ, we hear Messiah, right? And so that's what it means to us, the anointed one. But one can be anointed and not be God, such as most of the kings of Israel. They were all anointed to be kings. So they were Christed in that sense. But what the council wanted to clarify in not accepting the word Christotokos, but in insisting on the word Theotokos, is to clarify to us forever that this is the Mother of God. Okay? Mother of God. So this icon we look at as the incarnation or the first coming of Christ. And in any church, this is where it will be. Right? And then passing over to this side, this is called the Pantocrator. So you know the word pan, like embracing everything. If you're talking about Greeks uniting, you would say it's a pan-Hellenic council. So all the Greeks are coming together to work on something, which they would never do. They can't get along. But if there were such a thing as Greeks getting along, that's what it would be called. So it actually, interesting, it's an interesting word. It goes back, where have you heard pan before?
Pandemic.
Well, pandemic is a disease everywhere, right? Covering the planet.
Pantheism.
Right, pantheism, right? All gods, all the gods. But Pan was one of the early gods, right? And he was considered the greatest god at one time by the polytheist. And so this is sort of the root of that word. It comes from Pan because he was the god over everything else, which is very incorrect. But that's how the word got into the language in that way. So this is the Pantocrator, or the all-creator. You know, this is the Word made flesh who creates the entire universe and everything in it. Okay? So he's the Pancreator. When he comes in his first incarnation, he comes, in a sense, hidden. He's in the flesh. The only time that we really see his glory was Peter, James, and John at the Mount of Transfiguration, as you'll recall, when he sort of parted his flesh, as it were, and reveals his glory. We call that the Transfiguration, right? He was on Mount Tabor, and they saw him brighter than the sun. They saw Moses and who was there? Moses and Elijah, who were with him, and they were conversing with him about what was going to happen with him, about his demise, as it's described. And so that's who he is when he's not in the form of the incarnate child. Now, it's interesting, too, that, you know, this is God who's coming to earth, but he, you know, we would think, at least I would think, I think most of us would, if God's coming to earth, it's going to be a big deal, right? I mean, he's going to make a big splash, and everyone's going to know and that sort of thing, but that's not how he did it. You know, he came, you know, in the dead of winter. His mother had to ride a donkey with him, you know, all the way from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and then they don't have any place for him to be born. Now, what kind of a God deal is that? But that's what his life was like. Everything about it is very human, very humble. You know, he was a handyman's son. You know, we talk about Joseph being a carpenter. If you actually look at the root of that word, as it's used in the scripture, he was a handyman. You know, he would go and fix things in people's homes. So Joseph was a handyman, and Jesus lived there, you know, humbly before all of them. And even in the course of his life and his ministry, you know, he didn't show his divinity other than in the messianic signs. So at any point, you know, he could have said, here, I'm going to move the sun like this. Now, here's the moon. I'm going to bring it up, bring it down, bring it up, bring it down. Of course he could do all that. You know, he created those things, so it's not a problem for him. But he veiled his divinity because he wanted people, he wants us to respond to him not because of the big things he does, but because of his love for us. So he came here not to show us fireworks, but to show us love. I'll never forget, I was driving, actually I wasn't driving, I was riding, my wife was driving, and I was just learning about the Orthodox Church, and I was reading a book that was way over my head. What would a brand new Orthodox guy want to read? The mystical theology of the Orthodox Church. So I was reading something that I didn't understand. I read it again about a year ago. I still don't understand it, but it's a beautiful book. At any rate, in this book, it started talking about the Orthodox perspective on the crucifixion. And I always had understood it in that sort of forensic sense that God was angry. And because he was angry, he had to kill his son in order to have his anger appeased, right? And once he had killed his son, that appeased his anger, and therefore he would not see people's sins anymore. Everyone was sort of under the blood at that point, okay? That's a primarily Protestant concept. And what Lasky was talking about in this book was something I'd never even heard before all my life. And what he was pointing out was that he was saying that God is not angry. God does not have to appease himself. God does not have to kill his own son in order to appease his anger. He's not like that. God is loving all the time. And the reason that the Lord went to the cross was to reveal to us the depth of his love for us, that he would suffer the pain and difficulty of the cross, which as fully man he did. You know, he felt every bit of it, that he did that to show us so that it would be clear to us how much he absolutely loves us and how much God loves us. Radically different concepts, aren't they? Radically different. Okay. So the Lord comes the second time, quoting the scripture, in glory. And it says that when he comes, it will be like lightning flashing from the east to the west. So you always hear these, you know, things about, you know, Jesus is hanging out in the Cedars of Lebanon. He'll be revealing himself very soon. He's in this place. He's in that place. He's in London in an apartment. I've heard all these things through the years, many more. And he's just waiting until everyone has internet, you know, so that he can speak to the whole world all at once. So we've got to really rebuild that temple and promote the internet, you know, so that he can speak. Well, he doesn't need that. I grew up in Oklahoma, and one of the things we loved to do was to sleep out under the stars, particularly during hay season, because we'd load all the hay onto the wagon, so we'd keep some on there and sleep at night because it was so cool out in the country to lie on your back and you could look up and just see a gazillion stars because there was no light pollution out there. But every once in a while we'd have have one of those dry storms, as they call them, that would come through. And so the lightning, rather than being vertical, where it would come down, would be horizontal. It would go from the east to the west, or the west to the east, or whatever. But biblically, it would go from the east to the west. And what would happen when that happened was, the highest were geared to darkness, right? And it would absolutely light everything, just for the briefest moment. And because your eyes were not adjusted to it, you could see things like you might see a piece of grass, a blade of grass with a little insect or something on it, just for the briefest moment. Okay, but it would just illumine everything. And that's what the scripture is communicating, that it won't be quiet when he returns. And there won't be, you know, it won't be a thing where it'll have to be reported on the CNN or whatever. That it will be like lightning from the east to the west. Everyone will know. And so the second coming is him coming in judgment, you know, to basically stand before on the throne and to judge the world. And so in this one, he is the Panto creator, the creator of all the world. This reveals his second coming, when he will come in glory. In other words, in light, as he really is, as Peter, James, and John saw him. And if you think about that kind of light, you know, there's really nothing that hides from it. You know, it isn't like on the other side of the earth, therefore you can't see it. It permeates absolutely everything and everyone, and it reveals us. All right, so first coming, second coming. On this side, on the iconostasis, is always the icon of St. John the Baptist, the greatest of the Old Testament, greatest born among women, greatest Old Testament prophet. Now, icons are symbolic in the sense that they reveal things, make things clear. They're not always actual in the sense that everything in them is exactly realistic. Otherwise, how could we have his head here and his head here all at once? Well, it's showing us what happened in his life. And he has wings like an angel does. So if you see an icon of an angel like this one, you see those same wings on it. Is that telling us that John was an angel? No. What it's telling us is that John lived what the church calls the angelic life. John was what could be called an Old Testament monk. Okay, he was a Nazarite. So he didn't cut his hair, didn't eat meat, didn't drink wine or anything like that, alcohol, anything of that sort, lived out in the wilderness by himself and prayed before God until he was ready to come and, you know, and fulfill his prophetic duties. He was related to the Lord, of course. And so this one is showing, you know, it says, prophetically says, I bring the axe, you know, to the roots, you know, to cut down the proud and so on. So all of those things are in this icon. Okay? All right. Any questions before I go on?
Just this little scroll.
It says, can you read it?
Hand.
How old are you? If you're over 45, you should be able to read that. Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Now also the axe is laid to the root of the tree, therefore every tree which... .. Okay. And this is coming to me, ye who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Okay. All right. So this is the icon you would always see to the right of Christ. You know, when James and John said, I want to be on your right and on your left, he said, that's already appointed. You get to see who they are.
Well, explain the font over Christ, the WON.
Yeah. He who is. Yeah. That, you know, you hear, especially in the book of John, for instance, you hear I am all the time. Right? I am this, I am that, I'm the other thing. What he's using is the name of God, the Old Testament name of God. You know, like when Moses goes to the burning bush and he says, who are you? He says, I am who am, right? I am Yahweh. And so that's what it's describing. So it's saying that he, of course, is that God, Yahweh, who appeared to Moses, who appeared to Isaiah, and so on. Okay. Jesus Christus. Now, from here, the icons vary a little bit because the set icons are the four there. Then there might be further ones that go out in this direction. This one is an icon of Archbishop John Maksimovich, who died in San Francisco in 1966. Okay. One of the things I want you to do at some point is to look at this one. Well, actually, we can do this. Ramson, would you go down and get, there's a photograph of him right down there.
Where?
You can't miss it. It's the only photograph in the church because it's not supposed to be in here. You're only supposed to have icons and not photographs other than the bishops in the entrance. But I like to keep it in here because he's, because who he is, and so that you can compare an image, an icon. Can you see? Okay. By the way, he was not even 5 feet tall. He was a little tiny guy, and he had a hair lip, so he spoke with a lisp. And without going into a lot of things about St. John the Wonder Worker, which I would love to do, I just want you to see this comparison. Iconography is not, even though it isn't realistic in the sense of like a portrait or a photograph, you know that if you've ever seen a portrait artist, you let people see that. If you move it around, please. A portrait artist, if the person is really good, he or she, you know, doesn't, in a portrait, doesn't try to do a photographic image. Have you seen that? Really fine portrait artists? What they do is they attempt to sort of capture something within the person so that it isn't totally realistic, but that it conveys more of the inner person. So I remember someone describing this when a person was painting a portrait of Frank Lloyd Wright, and he really wanted to, you know, to sort of get him. And so he asked them this question that was kind of insulting about his architecture. And Frank had this expression like, "You don't understand, you don't get it." And that's what he captured. And so it's considered to be a really, really wonderful portrait because it shows that side of that determined, you know, depth of the man. So an icon is like that in the sense that it follows spiritual principles. So it isn't an effort to represent photographically what the person looks like, but rather it's a spiritual portrait, so that you don't, in a sense, get lost in the sort of earthliness of it. Okay, but at the same time, once you've seen this icon and you've seen this photograph, anywhere you go now where there's an icon of Archbishop John, you're going to know it. You'll recognize him. You know, they vary a little. Here's one that's a little bit different, but you're going to know it. And I think I described to you, I don't recall if we did, but Peter and Paul, for instance, you wonder like, okay, well, they were painting icons of these people, you know, all the way from the first century on. You know, are they accurate? Or are icons of Christ in any way accurate to what he looked like? Okay. So I can walk up to the icons over there, Peter and Paul, look at them, and I say, here's Peter, here's Paul. I can pick them 95% of the time, maybe, almost closer to 98, because they look the same. Now, a little different according to Greek style or Russian style or whatever, but essentially they look the same. And so I think it was in the 60s, there was a dig that was in Rome, and they unearthed a coin that came from mid-first century, and it was about this big, and it was on it had the image of Peter and Paul, you know, kind of like yin and yang divided like that. Looks exactly like the icons do. Okay, so when you see the icons of Peter and Paul, you're pretty close to seeing what they look like. You know, it isn't just some artist's thought of how would I do this, but iconographers. Unlike modern artists, a modern artist is always trying to come up with something new and unique and expressing themselves. An iconographer doesn't do that. They try to be true to the tradition that was handed on to them. So, you know, being a hyper-creative iconographer is not a good thing. Being a traditional iconographer and respecting the image and bringing it forward, it's always going to look a little different, you know, according to the iconographer, but it should be recognizable as to who it is. Now, right behind me is an example of how different it can be culturally. Okay, do you know what kind of icon this is?
Ethiopian.
It's Ethiopian, yeah. So iconography in the Ethiopian setting, or as you'd see in the back of the church, we'll look at those in just a minute, in the Coptic or Egyptian setting, are very different looking. Egyptian and Ethiopian are more similar, let's say, than 17th century Russian, but at the same time, it's also the same thing. Okay? So this is, you know what icon this is?
Annunciation.
Yeah, it's the Annunciation. So this is the Archangel Gabriel. This is the Theotokos, and he's announcing to her that she'll become the Mother of God. Now, the beauty of it to me, in part, and there are many things about it, but the beauty of it is that if you've ever been to Ethiopia and you've seen the people and you've seen the culture and been in it, this is how they see things. Bright colors, you know, large-eyed, beautiful people, and kind of a childlike beauty in their culture. And so their iconography expresses it. And so it isn't that iconography is this rigid thing, you know, where, well, gosh, that doesn't look like a Russian icon, so I don't like it, or it isn't Byzantine enough or something like that. It's the way the church does every culture. It, you know, it enters in to the culture, it baptizes it, and it brings out the best in it. But it is that culture. So the way they do music, you know, the way music is done in an Ethiopian church is very upbeat compared to what we do. And for instance, I spent about a month and a half in Africa, and you know, the in that setting, most of the areas that I went, the native priests had been given Byzantine chant as their basic way, like what you would see in a Greek or an Antiochian church, is how they sing. Well, it's barely left, you know, because they sing on the upbeat, not the downbeat. And like, when they're getting ready for communion, they're up dancing. They're just dancing and singing and going like this. You know, can you imagine that here? But that's who they are. You know, that's who they are, and that's how they express life. And it, so after the liturgy, you know, after the liturgy is over, you have lunch and you're sitting out there, and then all the men come out and dance, and then all the women come out and dance, and then all the kids come out and dance, and then they drag you up and you horribly dance with them. But that's what they do. They dance. That's how they express joy. And the music that they sing over lunch sounds just about like the music that was in the church. But that's fine. That's incarnate orthodoxy. Okay. Now, going over here, keep this image in mind and scoot over here. And there you see it again. Okay. So the icon that you see to the left of the Theotokos, or the incarnation, first incarnation of Christ, or the incarnation of Christ, is the icon of the church. This is the Church of the Annunciation, with an A, not an E. Occasionally I get mail that I guess they assume that we speak really well here. We articulate things. Church of the Annunciation. And this, again, is the same as that icon, but look how different they are. Right? Really different. Icon, this is the Archangel, this is the Theotokos. Now, it's interesting. If you go, and I hope you all do someday, go to Nazareth, you'll go to the Church of the Annunciation, right? And I remember the first time that I went there, and it was the first thing that really threw me off. It was one of the first places that I went, and I knew we were in Nazareth, but I didn't think about it being the Church of the Annunciation. I thought it was just the Greek church in Nazareth. And I was quite fascinated by the fact that the door was this high. So that meant to get in, you either had to get like this or you had to crawl in. Now, what that is about is that it goes back to the time of the Crusades. Because when the Catholic Crusaders came, they would destroy the mosque and they would destroy the Orthodox churches. So they would just go in with swords and cut the icons and, you know, destroy the temples and, you know, that sort of thing. And so the Orthodox made the doors so low so if they were going to come in and do that stuff, at least they couldn't do it on their horses. So if you go, for instance, to the Church of the Nativity, to the Catholic side, there are a lot of things that are Catholic here and Orthodox here. You go to the Catholic side, it's a regular door. You just go in. If you go to the Orthodox side, you've got this action to get in. So, you know, all interesting history about this. But I you know, got in, and so the church is there, and then on the far side is a sort of fence, and like a railing, really. And I wasn't sure what that was, but there was a service going on. So I looked up at the iconostasis where the readers were, and I saw the icon of the Annunciation in that spot. And I thought, oh, this is a church of the Annunciation, just like the one where I served. And then I thought, no, this is the church of the Annunciation. This is the one, the actual one. And then if you go across the church, you go to what's called Mary's Well. And the most one of the most authenticating things in the Holy Land is wells, you know, where the wells were, where the water is. And so this was the well in Nazareth where everyone would go to get water. Now, as with most things that are that old, you know, that, you know, this that well was on the surface back during that time, on the surface of the city. Now it's about 30 feet under, because in most of these cases, the cities get destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt. So when you visit sites in Jerusalem, for instance, Pool of Siloam, things like that, they're way down below the surface of where the city is now in most cases. Okay, that was the case with this. And the tradition is that when Mary came to the well, that's when the archangel met her and, you know, expressed to her that she would be the mother of God. And that's the well right there. And there are these steps that come down now, you know, to it. And it's interesting because, you know, a step looks like this, right? Just like that. Only these steps are hollowed out like that, because so many people have walked down them through the centuries to get to them. You'll see that in Jerusalem as well, where, you know, where the 90 degree thing is long gone. It's totally beveled out like that. I saw a hand. Yeah.
The Church of the Annunciation that you mentioned at Bethlehem, is that representative of where the Annunciation actually took place?
It's where it happened.
That's where it happened.
Okay. We're reasonably sure. If it really did happen at the well's there. The church was built over the well. Yeah. So I the person who explained that to me was our Armenian guide, because I was asking him these questions, and he was an agnostic, but he said he was an atheist. But he really knew his archaeology. And so I enjoyed the guy so much. I just spent a lot of time sitting with him and talking with him, and he took me on a couple of private tours of places in Jerusalem. But he said, you know, I am an atheist, but I have to admit that the Bible is our best source of archaeology when we do digs and things like that. It's, you know, it's pretty darned accurate. I don't know why, but it is. Okay, so this is what you would see. Then this, again, is usually... To put it very simply, the icons that are up here, other than those four, are usually the icons that the church likes and wants there. And this is the icon of Saint Herman. It's appropriate that he's here because he's our first saint in America. Even though he was in Russia and Alaska at the time, he is the first saint in America, the proto-saint of America, the first. Okay. And these are called deacon's doors. Okay, so they open, the deacons come in and out. Right, so that obvious the name. These are not proper. Sometimes archangels are on them because archangels come to announce things, which is what a deacon does. But normally you would have, like, say, the first martyr Stephen, the deacon, and then Lawrence, who was one of the most early deacons, on the other door. That would be normal, rather than the archangel. And guess who that is? No. You know who that is, don't you? That is, hold on. Hold your breaths. Who is this?
Peter and Paul.
Getting along. which they didn't always do. Their big fight was the cause of the first apostolic council. And guess who was right? The infallible Peter? No, Paul was right. So Peter wasn't infallible. There you go. All right, so see the same? Semblance? Yeah, that's Peter. Who's on the other door? Yeah. Sorry to make you walk all this much, but recognize,
yeah.
We'll see that little tuft of hair there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's Paul. And you can pretty much take it to the bank. Can you put that back? Thank you. All right. Then, as you go up, if you're in a place like Russia, and it's a huge church, this might go up 50, 60 feet. But what normally would happen on the next level would be the icons of the feasts, the great feasts of the church, such as the Transfiguration, Theophany, the baptism in the Jordan, the Mystical Supper, Pentecost, things like that. Those are there. And then these other two icons that are right in the center are normal, but not always the ones that you would see. But since they're here, I'll point them out to you as to what they are. The one in the very center is the Mystical Supper. Typically, that's behind the altar, which it is here. But it also very often is on the iconostasis, because this is where the Mystical Supper takes place. So it points to it, right? Above that is kind of an unusual icon, not if you know your Old Testament fairly well. You'll realize that at the Oak of Mamre in the background is where the three visitors came and spoke with Abraham. You know, talked about the fact that he, at 99, he would become a father and would be a father of a great nation. And this is where Sarah laughed at that expression and gave the name to her son Isaac, which means laughter. And but this is where this is called sometimes the hospitality of Abraham. And it is a symbolic icon of the Trinity. Now, we can't show the Trinity, can we? Because the Father has no image in that sense. The Holy Spirit, at best, would have to be in the form of a dove, which occasionally is done symbolically, but of course the Holy Spirit isn't a dove. The only image that we actually have of God is in Christ, in the face of Christ, right? Right. So the archangels symbolically stand in for the Trinity. And basically, you know, God the Father behind, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And so it's a symbolic icon, or what's sometimes called a theological icon. So it isn't a realistic icon in that sense, although it does describe a biblical event. Okay. All right. Now I'm going to open the doors. So there's nothing secret in the church. You know how Masons have secrets? Okay, so there's nothing secret in the church, but there are a lot of sacred things in the church, things that are holy, things that are set apart, just as there were in the temple. Okay? So that means that what we're doing right now is not a bad thing, or something that you shouldn't see because you're not a priest or anything like that. None of this is hidden. None of this is something that you shouldn't see and understand, and I want to teach you what it is. But at the same time, understand that, you know, that this is the holy altar, and so it's held in high reverence, and when we come in here, we're very quiet. We behave in a very reverent way. And there are a lot of things that have to do with the movements in here and that sort of thing that we're very careful about. So this is this whole space is called the altar. This is called the holy table. Okay, and you can see that it's a cube, right? Just like the altar in the temple in Jerusalem was. It was cubic. And on the altar in an Orthodox church are three things. One is the gospel. Okay, so this is the gospel writers, Matthew and John. Okay, so that sits on the altar, and when it's going to be read, it's carried processionally out into the church. Okay? Now, it's called an illumined gospel because it's covered, you know, covered with gold and that sort of thing, gold plated. And so we reverence it. You know, we bow when people bring it by. People kiss the gospel. And what they're doing when they do that is that they're expressing their thanksgiving to God for having given us Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In other words, the words of Christ, the actions of Christ, all of those things. We're reverencing that fact. Okay? So this is placed on the center of the altar. The cross, the blessing cross, is next to that. There's nothing else that's on there other than the other thing there. That's the tabernacle and what's called the antimension. So blessing cross is there. The cloth that is on is there just, you know, to give it a soft place because it has a glass top. Okay? And again, it's a beautiful cross. And this is the cross that's brought out when you come up and commemorate and that sort of thing. Again, you kiss the cross if you do, because you are expressing your appreciation to the Lord for going to the cross for us. Okay, that's the expression of kissing his feet on the cross. Now, I'm not going to open this because if you looked at it, you would see that. This is called the antimension, and it's what it means is in the place of the table or over the table. And so basically what you have in the antimensia, which is this, this is called the epitaphios, used in Holy Week. You know, it's like when you go through the movement of Holy Week, it's out in the center of the church in a funeral bier, flowers all around it and everything. So it's the burial of Christ after the cross. So what you have there is the myrrh-bearing women, the archangels hovering over, And a few of the apostles who are there. Joseph of Arimathea, for instance, is there. And so they're burying the Lord in his tomb. Huge discussion could go around that. It's not for tonight. And so the antimensia is signed by the bishop for the particular church. So it's a Church of the Annunciation, Archbishop Tikhon in this case. And in the center of the antimensia is a relic or a bone that comes from a martyr. Not just any saint, but a martyred saint. Okay? Now, this harkens back to the catacombs. Because when the early Christians would go out to the catacombs to worship, they would go in the middle of the night. That's where our all-night vigils came from, because it wasn't safe to go out during the day. Okay? To you know, worship together was something they had to really try to do quietly. And so they were constantly having new martyrs, you know, people where the Romans would find out that they were Christians and they would kill them for it, you know, if they wouldn't offer incense to Caesar. So it became their habit to have the liturgy or the service on the relics of the newest martyr. So it became then ultimately the practice of the church that the antimensia that would sit, that would be on the table, would have a relic of a martyr in it in commemoration of that period of life in the church. So it isn't, it has to be a martyr, not just a saint in general. And it also is something that the bishop gives that if it isn't there, we can't do anything here. We can't have a divine liturgy, for instance. That's his permission or his blessing to do that. So say, for instance, you have a church that's in a state of disobedience and they're fighting and all that sort of thing, and they're fighting the bishop. He would send a dean or someone. They would simply go in the church, take the antimensia, and they're done until things get straightened out. Okay, so it has this authority. Essentially, when you see it, it has this authority to do the Orthodox services here. That's the antimensia. And it's opened up during the liturgy and everything, so the service is done on that. This is the tabernacle. Okay, so inside the tabernacle up here in what looks like a little coffin almost is reserved gifts. So this is body and blood of Christ that has been consecrated on Holy Thursday specifically. And then it's dried and it's placed in there. And we use that when we go to visit people who are sick and things like that. So that we can take communion to them. So you can, you know, I can look in that by about December of every year and see how many really sick people there have been, you know, in the church during that year. If you get four or five people with cancer or something like that, it's probably going to be empty by this time and we have to refill it. So that's something that regularly happens on a Sunday afternoon. And interestingly, they always tell us that if the church burns, this is the thing you grab. Okay, so if the church is in flame, this is what you grab and save. And that literally happened here because that building over there burned down at one time. And the church was on, and the fire was on the roof of this building before the fire department was able to put it out. The deacon knew about this, you know, he heard about it, and he came over here, and he went into the church, and all the firemen were trying to stop him because obviously they didn't want anyone in the church. And so they were chasing him, and he came up here and got this thing and climbed out the window over there, and he was on the roof of that thing, and so they arrested him. And so when I got here a little later, he was in the back of the police car, and so I had to talk them into letting him go. I said, he was doing a good thing. Believe me, he was doing what he had to do. So it actually does happen. And so behind that, of course, is the seven-branch candlestick, which goes back to the temple worship. Behind that, normally, is the icon of the mystical supper, because that's what takes place here. Above that, usually up there, really big, is the icon of the Panagia, the Panagios, or the All Holy, and that is an icon of the Theotokos with Christ in her womb. Okay? And the reason that it's put there, I remember the first time I went in an Orthodox church, I looked at that big icon of the Theotokos of Mary above the altar, and I thought, I knew they were worshiping Mary at these Catholic churches. I didn't know the difference between Catholic and Orthodox, but I knew they were worshiping her. Look, they don't even have Jesus up there. You know, Jesus should be there. There's Mary. Oh, it's terrible. Well, I didn't understand. Because the reason that she's there is because, of course, the focus of that icon is Christ. Her image is called the Orans. So if you went into the catacombs, there's still a few of these left, but this is what they were drawing in the catacombs. The very early Christians were the Orans, which is an attitude of prayer. Okay? And so that's what she represents there. But this is the icon of the incarnation, the birth, you know, the gestation, you might say, of Christ. And if you put all this together, basically you have the mystical supper where bread and wine are becoming the body and blood of Christ, received by the faithful so that they can grow and be restored in the image of Christ, to use the words of St. Paul, so that they could bear Christ in their flesh, right? By the gift of his gifts. And so basically what this doing is, it's iconographically saying, here's what we're doing, here's your vocation. Here's your vocation. It's the same as hers was, which is to say yes to God rather than no to God, and then to open yourself in obedience and willingness to have Christ born in you, and to, over time, have that increase and increase so that your communion with him increases, which is salvation, actually. Okay. All right. So let's see what else. Oh, the processional cross, eternal flame above it, processional cross here, which is tilted. They always do this to me. All right. And then these are fans, which I always thought were like something Greeks probably did because they couldn't stand dead airspace. So they put the cherubim, put the six-winged seraphim on the fans and put them behind the altar, and you can carry them when you have processions. Until I went to Africa. And when in Africa, a lot of bugs. So you have right here a chalice with wine in it, and right over here you have bread on a discos or a paten. And subdeacons stand at the side during the entire service and hold it like this and flick flies and flick bugs away on both sides. They're doing it the whole time. That's what they're actually for. We don't normally have that problem, but I was glad to see that they weren't merely liturgical flourishes. Okay.
So then why are they still important as to be part of the divine liturgy if they have more of a practical purpose and not so much of a spiritual purpose?
Well, you know how Orthodox are. Change.
Change.
That's right. That's right. So we have a gold, you know, golden fly swatter back there, essentially. Yeah. But what you'll find is I don't hold these things back from you. You know, I don't put mystical meanings on them or anything like that, because I want you to understand what they're really there for. Because a lot of it's just practical. You know, it's just practical stuff that then became more like liturgically there, but it was there for a reason. Okay. All right, any questions about anything? I'll show you a little bit more, but any questions about what you're seeing here? Nope. All right. So if you get at this angle, you look over here, if you have a scene, come right up here and look in. It's fine. Just don't step in, if you would. You can open that door. Yeah. This is called a table of preparation. And you know that when you're at Divine Liturgy that there comes a point where the gifts are prepared and then they're carried through the church. Okay? We'll talk more about that later. It's called the Great Entrance. That's where the word remembrance is used a lot. But what we'll do, not this Sunday, but next Sunday, is that we'll move this table out there into the church and we'll do the preparation or the proskomidi out there so that you can see how it's done and you'll hear the words of it. So the next thing we'll be studying is the Divine Liturgy. That's right in the early part of it. Okay, so not this week, I'll remind you, on Sunday, but you'll need to come at about 9:10, right in that range. Okay, and might have a baptism that Sunday, I'm not sure. That would mess things up.
Not this week, but next week.
I think so, it depends on when that baptism is. It's an infant, so I have to check on that. I could be making myself a liar right now. So I want to be sure, but I'll let you know on Sunday. It'll either be the week after this Sunday or 2 weeks after, depending on that.
The baptism's on the 24th.
24th?
That's what I heard.
Good, I'm glad you know that. All right, so that means it'll be the next Sunday, not this coming, the one after. And it'll just be right out here, and I'll ask you all to come up. You'll come up rather timidly, and you'll try to stand behind me, and I won't let you do that. I'll force you to get up above me so that you can actually look at it and hear the words that I'm saying, and I'll explain it to you. Okay, so be bold. All right, so that's where the chalices and discus and things like that are. Over on this side is just, you know, where we vest and where we have our books and things like that. Okay?
Who determines, like, the icons on the sides? Are they just ones you guys like?
Tend to be. Here's the thing about this church. It isn't finished. Okay? It was... A lot of the things that are here are just sort of what have happened over time. When we do this sort of major renovation that we're getting ready to, all of this will be plaster like that is. Okay, there will be an apse back there. It'll be rounded, and that will all be plaster. So that icon will be painted on at that point as a fresco, and then the larger icon that window will be gone, and that large icon will be up there. Okay. And then, just like on, this is called the mercy seat sometimes, because it's the seat of Christ. And so to the right and the left of the mercy seat, just as it is on the Ark of the Covenant, are the icons of the two cherubim facing in. If you've ever seen a facsimile or a simile of that, it's really beautiful. So there are particular icons that go in particular places. Right now, this is what we have, and this is when we like to look at them. Later, it will be all frescoed, all painted on with frescoes. And, you know, there's certainly options with that. And so we'll make some choices around that, but there are also particular things that go in particular places, like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's blessing. Jesus Christus Nika. If your fingers were spelling Greek, that's what they say. So when a priest gives a blessing, it's like this. When a bishop gives us a blessing, he's like this. So he's the high priest or the episkopoi, the bishop. the high priest in heaven.
I know the cup, what the one below that is.
Mystical Supper.
Oh, okay.
The Last Supper. Da Vinci.
Yeah. And St. Tikhon is on the right.
Yeah.
Because
I like him. And I want to look at him.
Right. He's a nice guy.
Yeah. Because he's an American saint. Because he's the called the Enlightener of America, because he was the bishop over all the Orthodox churches in America at one time, and I like that that was the case at that time. And because if you ever read his life, you'll love him.
How old is he now?
He's dead.
Oh, he's dead now.
Yeah, he was turn of the century. He was murdered by the communists.
Okay, so
he was the Patriarch of Moscow at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution.
Okay, so I thought there was somebody that had his name now.
Yeah. Our Metropolitan has his name.
Right. Okay, so that's okay. All right.
Yeah, but our Metropolitan doesn't get to heaven.
Right. That's what I was saying. I was getting to. That's what I was saying.
That remains to be seen.
That's what I was getting confused. I was like, Tikhon. Yeah. Okay, because the seminary. But right,
that would be premature too. Sainthood.
Right. That's what I was like, wait, I need that name. I'm like, well, I was confused.
Yeah, most of the names are reused. Oh, those are from Palm Sunday. We always leave a few up just to remember.
Yeah. Is this where you guys put your students?
Mm-hmm, that's where we invest. Yeah.
And the throne is the bishop's throne, is that correct?
That is the bishop's throne.
Right.
Yeah. It's really Christ's throne.
Right.
But the bishop represents Christ, not represents Christ. Because he can't, but he represents him in the sense that because Christ, you know, isn't here in person, the bishop stands in, just as a priest does, although we don't sit there.
And that's
what the Pope calls himself. Well, yeah, the Christ is the head of the church, no man is.
Right.
Okay, that's huge. Yeah, so, and even the way that we understand priesthood is very different than Rome does. And I'll go into that when we talk about certain things around that, but it's a very different perspective on priesthood. That brought up one other thing. Oh, yeah. So the actual rector or overseer, episcopoi, of this church is the bishop. Okay, so I just work for him. I'm the stand-in. Okay? So... and that's true of every church because he's, you know, the church isn't whole in a certain sense until he's here. Then everything is here. And so the throne is behind there in part because it reminds us that we are under obedience, you know, that I work for someone and that I'm under obedience to him. Okay. As we understand obedience, not silly kind, but good kind. All right, any other questions? Otherwise, we'll close it from here.
Is he also the bishop of Alaska?
No, just the West Coast.
Just the West Coast?
For the one that's over this church, Archbishop Benjamin.
So it doesn't go up to the coast of Alaska?
No, different one up there. Okay. That's a big diocese up there. Yeah. You have to think of Alaska as being Russia, okay, when the Russians had it before they sold it to Seward. Mm-hmm. Seward's Icebox, remember that? And so they missionized all the native peoples up there. So there are little Orthodox churches everywhere up there. And most of the native people have Russian last names. Lots of them do. And all the streets are Russian and that kind of thing. So you get a dose of Russia when you go to Alaska, especially the older areas. Yeah, and they all speak Russian. Yeah, most of the natives speak their Tlingit in Russian or Aleut in Russian. So they kind of love their Russian heritage.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. All right, time's up. You might want to take a glance at the Egyptian or Coptic icons on the back wall on the left on your way out, because they're really beautiful. You'll see the burning bush there. See if you can pick it out.